Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a word that, well, frankly, it's kind of become an insult these days, rhetoric. You hear it and you immediately think, you know, empty spin, political manipulation, maybe just trickery trying to hide the truth.
Right. And that cynicism, that's really part of the issue itself. Richard Toya, in his work, he lays out how dismissing an argument as mere rhetoric, well, that's actually one of the most powerful rhetorical moves you can make today.
Huh, that's ironic. Using language to shut down language.
Exactly. But Toya argues, pretty convincingly, I think, that if you just dismiss rhetoric entirely, you're missing the vital living structure, sometimes it's almost invisible, of how we communicate. It shapes everything. Politics, sure, but also just, you know, talking with colleagues.
Okay, so our goal here today is to shift that perception for you, the listener. We want to help you move from just sort of passively receiving persuasive messages.
Which are everywhere.
Absolutely everywhere. To becoming a more active, conscious analyst. Doesn't matter if it's a CEO, a news anchor, a politician, even a family member trying to convince you of something.
Right. We're aiming to give you the basic toolkit. Kind of like civic self-defense for living in this incredibly fast-paced, media-heavy world.
So let's unpack that. Where do we start? The beginning. Ancient Greece.
Makes sense. For the Greeks, I mean, rhetoric wasn't some optional extra. It was absolutely core to democratic life. If you wanted to participate in the assembly or defend yourself in court,
you had to be able to speak persuasively.
You had to. If you couldn't argue your case effectively, you were basically sidelined, a non-participant.
But wasn't there tension there from the start? I seem to remember Plato being quite skeptical.
Oh, absolutely. Plato was deeply suspicious. He tended to see rhetoric as sophistry. You know, a collection of tricks that cared more about sounding persuasive than actually being true. He worried it was just a form of flattery to manipulate people.
So was his big worry that style could beat substance? That charisma could just steamroll actual logic?
That's precisely the dilemma, and it's still with us today, isn't it? Plato worried that the skill, the technique, could be completely detached from morality or truth.
But his student, Aristotle, he saw it differently.
He did. Aristotle took a much more, let's say, systematic and pragmatic approach. He saw rhetoric as necessary, a counterpart to logic almost. His point was, look, even if truth and justice are on your side, they won't automatically win out.
They need a voice.
They need to be articulated effectively. They need to be persuasive. Otherwise, falsehood or injustice might just win the day through better PR, essentially.
And Aristotle gives us that foundational framework, the one that really underpins everything else.
Yeah.
The three appeals.
Yes. The big three. Logos, pathos, and ethos. And what's amazing is how durable they are. These modes of persuasion, they work just as well for analyzing a Roman speech as they do for, say, a tweet from a modern politician.
Okay, break them down. Logos.
Logos is the appeal to logic. It's about the argument itself, the evidence, the facts, the structure, the reasoning. Does it hold water?
Right. And pathos.
Pathos is the appeal to emotion. It's designed to stir feelings in the audience. Maybe anger, maybe pity, patriotism, fear, hope, solidarity. You name it.
Okay. Logos, logic. Pathos, emotion. That brings us to ethos. This one feels particularly relevant today.
It really is. Ethos is the appeal based on the speaker's perceived character, their credibility, their authority, their trustworthiness.
And Toya makes a key distinction here, doesn't he? It's not about what you say about yourself.
Exactly. It's not your bio. It's not boasting about your credentials. Ethos is what the audience believes about you. And that belief is built up over time based on your words, your actions, your reputation. It's essentially trust translated into persuasive power.
That link between character and skill, was that always there?
Very much so in the classical tradition. The Roman educator Quintilian famously defined the ideal orator as the vir bonus, dicendi peritus.
Which means?
A good man, skilled in speaking. It wasn't just a nice phrase, it set an ethical standard. The assumption was that true mastery of rhetoric required, or at least should require, strong moral character.
Okay, so it's foundational in the classical world. But how did it survive? How did it adapt when, you know, the world changed?
Well, that's the proof of its resilience, isn't it? It adapted incredibly well.
Yep.
Take the shift from the Roman Forum to the Christian pulpit.
Right.
You have figures like St. Augustine in the early Christian era. He effectively baptized rhetoric. He consciously took the techniques honed by people like Cicero and Aristotle.
The classical toolkit.
Exactly. And applied them to Christian teaching and preaching. The sermon became this incredibly powerful, long-lasting form of mass communication that literally shaped Western culture and theology for centuries.
Okay, fast forward quite a bit. Age of Revolutions. Rhetoric is a force for, well, upheaval and building new things.
Absolutely. Think about the American Declaration of Independence. It's not just a list saying we're leaving.
No, it's an argument.
It's a masterclass in persuasion. It sets out principles, logos. Yeah. It makes a case based on grievances, logos again, appeals to ideals, pathos, and it's presenting this justification to the entire world, establishing the ethos of a new nation.
But rhetoric wasn't just for revolutionaries, right? Weren't there powerful voices arguing against change, using similar tools?
Oh, definitely. Think of someone like Edmund Burke in Britain around the same time. He was a master rhetorician, using equally powerful arguments, emphasizing tradition, stability, the dangers of radical change to make the conservative case against the French Revolution, for example. The tools were similar, the aims opposed.
This really brings us to seeing rhetoric used for social justice, often from voices that were previously excluded.
Yes, and this is where it gets incredibly inspiring. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech is probably the textbook example. It's just a perfect fusion of the three appeals.
How so?
Well, he appeals to core American principles, the Constitution, the Declaration, that's logos. He brings immense personal credibility and moral authority, that's his ethos. And of course, the vision he paints, that powerful emotional call for equality and unity, that's pure pathos. It fundamentally shifted the conversation.
And he wasn't alone in that tradition. Figures like Frederick Douglass before him?
Absolutely. Douglass, an escaped slave, using his own life story, his powerful testimony, and incredible eloquence to just expose the raw hypocrisy at the heart of American slavery. It shows that rhetoric isn't just fancy words, it's the very mechanism societies use to argue with themselves and sometimes to change for the better.
So rhetoric is this engine. What happens when technology completely changes the road, the communication channels?
It doesn't replace the engine, it just maybe adds a turbocharger or changes the kind of fuel it runs on most effectively. Technology amplifies and reshapes how the appeals work.
Or like radio.
Perfect example. FDR's fireside chats. Suddenly, the president wasn't a distant figure giving formal speeches. He was in your living room, speaking conversationally, intimately. That built enormous ethos and connection, pathos, in a way old-style oratory couldn't match on that medium.
Then TV. The Kennedy-Nixon debates are legendary for this, right?
Totally changed the game. Yes, what they said mattered. Logos. But suddenly, how they looked. Kennedy seeming cool and composed. Nixon looking sweaty and uncomfortable under the lights. That visual element became a huge rhetorical factor. It impacted perceived credibility, their ethos, instantly.
We even see this in the commercial world. I'm thinking of Steve Jobs launching Apple products.
A masterclass. Those weren't just tech specs. They were stories. He built anticipation, pathos, established Apple's innovative reputation, ethos, and yes, presented the product features, logos. But it was always wrapped in a larger narrative, a vision you were invited to join. Persuasion at its slickest, really.
Which leads us inevitably to the darker side. If it's just a tool,
then it's morally neutral, like a hammer you said earlier. It can build or it can destroy. And that's the crucial, sometimes uncomfortable truth about rhetoric.
So we have to contrast someone like King using rhetoric for inclusion
with the terrifyingly effective rhetoric of someone like Adolf Hitler. Hitler understood mass psychology. He used these huge choreographed rallies, constant repetition of simple slogans, scapegoating, and the infamous big lie technique.
Our whole being.
To bypass reason altogether. To whip up intense emotion, fear, hatred, blind loyalty, pathos, and to systematically dehumanize entire groups of people, making violence seem acceptable, even necessary.
And Toya points out something chilling here.
Yes. That in terms of formal techniques, using emotional appeals, building a strong persona, structuring arguments, the methods used by King to inspire good, and the methods used by Hitler to incite evil, they drew from the same fundamental rhetorical playbook.
That really underscores the power we're talking about. It's not inherently good or bad. It's about the user's intent and impact.
Precisely. And that brings us to now, the digital age, which presents its own unique set of challenges, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Social media means everyone's a publisher, everyone's a rhetorician now, in a way.
Right. Access is democratized. But the platforms themselves, the algorithms, they often reward brevity, strong emotion, pathos, maybe even outrage over careful, nuanced argument, logos.
Which can fuel polarization,
yeah.
Make it easier for misinformation to spread.
Exactly. Things can spread like wildfire, validated within echo chambers. Often before careful checking or logical scrutiny can catch up, nuance gets lost.
So this leads to what Toye identifies as maybe the biggest danger for us today, for you listening. It's not always the loud, obvious propaganda.
No. He warns that the most dangerous rhetoric, the most insidious kind, is often the rhetoric that pretends it isn't rhetoric at all. The kind that masquerades as neutral, objective information.
Explain that a bit more. How does that work?
Well, think about, say, a chart or graph in a business report or a news article. It looks purely factual, right? Pure logos, data.
Okay.
But what if the person presenting it carefully selected only certain data points? Or chose a scale on the graph specifically to exaggerate a trend, or conveniently left out conflicting information.
Ah, so they're using the appearance of pure logic to persuade you while actually shaping the narrative.
Precisely. It uses the credibility of data and objectivity as a cloak for a persuasive agenda. Spotting that requires real critical thinking, real rhetorical awareness.
Okay, so let's make this practical. How can understanding logos, pathos, and ethos help you, the listener, day to day?
Well, first, media literacy. When you encounter a news report, an opinion piece, even an advertisement, start actively identifying the appeals. Is this leaning heavily on emotional language, pathos? Is it trying to trigger fear or anger to maybe get you to bypass the logical flaws, logos, who is the source, and what's their perceived credibility ethos?
Just asking those questions makes you a more critical consumer.
Absolutely. And it's not just about defense. You can use it proactively. Think about work. Say you're a project manager pitching a big new idea. You need to build your case. You'll present data, the plan that's logos. You need to remind people of your track record, your team's competence that builds ethos. But the really great pitches, they connect the project to something bigger. Shared values, the company mission, the potential impact, that's the pathos that motivates people.
So it's about blending all three effectively. This lens also helps us understand historical figures, doesn't it? Churchill, rallying Britain in wartime.
A master of pathos and ethos in crisis. Or modern figures. Think about Barack Obama, how he blended very classical, eloquent speechmaking with savvy use of new media platforms. You can analyze how they achieve their effects.
So it really is essential for understanding the world, for participating effectively, for defending yourself intellectually?
Couldn't agree more. Rhetorical literacy allows you to both craft clearer, more ethical messages yourself, and also to critically dissect the persuasive attempts constantly bombarding you. It's vital for navigating our complex world.
So the big takeaway isn't that rhetoric is bad, or just for politicians. It's that it's fundamental, a core skill for how cultures evolve, how we influence each other, how we get things done.
Right. You need the skills to make your own case effectively and ethically, and you definitely need them to see through manipulation. The goal isn't just about becoming a slicker speaker. It's about becoming intellectually armored.
Mm-hmm. Defended.
Defended. Understanding ethos, pathos, logos lets you peel back the surface of almost any message and see the persuasive machinery underneath. That's just crucial in the 21st century with all the noise.
Okay, so let's leave our listeners with a final thought to chew on. Toy suggests something interesting about our current digital age.
Yes.
With information being so abundant, almost overwhelming, and trust often feeling scarce, he argues that ethos, your credibility, your perceived character, is becoming maybe the most dominant, most important appeal of the three.
That makes sense. When facts are disputed, when emotions run high, who do you trust?
Exactly. So the really crucial question for you listening right now is this. Knowing that your character, your perceived trustworthiness, is possibly your most powerful persuasive tool. How consciously, how consistently, and how ethically are you building your own ethos through what you say and what you do every single day?